Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Crystal, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. Today's program is part two of a five-part series. Today's program is titled Understanding the Costs of Care and Your Healthcare Coverage. And I know this is a topic on everyone's mind, and this is part of a series called Life with Cancer, A Guide to Getting the Best Care. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of this collaboration and your great interest in this particular topic at this time that we have on the call today over 601 participants. And you come from all over the United States, and we have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom, so it's a bit of a global call as well. And we're delighted to have all of you on the call today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us to learn more about this topic. Now, today's program is supported by AbbVie, Bristol-Myers Squibb, the Celgene Corporation, Takeda Oncology, an educational donation provided by Amgen, and a grant from Genentech. And I really want to thank them for their support, not only of today's program, but this entire series, and indeed for their corporate collaboration in making today's program possible. Now, we have really the best speakers on today's program, really wonderful speakers, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Leonard Saltz. Dr. Saltz is Chief Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Head Colorectal Oncology Section, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He's also a Professor of Medicine while at Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Saltz is really going to set the stage for today's program. He's going to present an overview of the medical and indirect costs of treatment, what to do when cancer treatment seems unaffordable, and talking with your healthcare team about your financial concerns. So it's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Saltz.
Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you today. I think by the very fact that you're on this call, you understand that a person with a cancer diagnosis has to be thinking about the financial implications. It would be wonderful if we could all just say, this is important, this is healthcare, this is survival, this is what needs to happen, and therefore money is no object, not a consideration. But unfortunately, there are real-world considerations that each individual dealing with cancer has to think carefully about, because thinking carefully about it will help you control it. And that, I think, is an important thing to keep in mind as you listen to all of the speakers today. The goal of this conference today is not to scare you, but to empower you, to help you to understand that although you face financial challenges, there are ways of dealing with them. I think that one of the most important things to do is recognize that there is the potential for the problem, but also that there are choices. There are choices that can be made in terms of where you get your care, which types of care you get, how you receive treatment in terms of inpatient versus outpatient, private office versus clinic, and so on. And to some degree, everyone who is dealing with a cancer diagnosis is going to need some advice for this. As with all things, when it comes to treatment for cancer, you have to be able to communicate with your doctor, and you have to be able to communicate with the rest of the medical team. As you've no doubt experienced, cancer care is a process that happens with an entire team. There are doctors, there are nurse practitioners and physician assistants, there are nurses, there are office assistants, there are our financial advisors often embedded within the office, and you have to learn what skill sets each of these people have and how you can access those people to your advantage, because that's what we're all here for. Now, one of the challenges that has to be overcome is opening the conversation. This is something that we would hope all doctors and healthcare providers were good at, and some are, and some aren't as strong. And so this is where, if you're not feeling that there's the opening that's being reached out to you to have conversations with your healthcare provider, you need to feel comfortable taking that step. It's fine to say, I'm concerned about the costs of this. I'm concerned about the cost of a treatment that has this many office visits. Is it possible to do something where I don't have to come as frequently so that either I or the people that are coming with me for my visits don't have to take off from work? Because, of course, one has to think about the so-called intrinsic costs of lost work time that's involved with a cancer diagnosis, both for the patient and for the people that are helping to care for that patient. And asking about choices that could make a difference in that are very important. Some treatments are given once a week. Some treatments are given every other week. Some treatments can be given on an every 2 or an every 3rd week schedule. And for some people, that makes no difference. And for some people, that makes a lot of difference. These are the kinds of things that you have to feel comfortable talking about. Remember, your doctor is going to always be asking you questions that you wouldn't normally discuss with everybody else. As doctors, we ask people about their bowel function, their bladder function, their sexual function, their fears, their concerns, their mood. It shouldn't seem unreasonable to then talk about what is also a very private and personal matter, which is money and finance and financial worry. So part of building that relationship with your healthcare team is opening that conversation if you need to do it, being receptive to that conversation if your healthcare provider is the one that initiates it, but understanding that whenever there are treatment decisions to be made, there are going to be financial implications, and there are often going to be choices. We can talk about whether we're going to use a more expensive or a less expensive drug if there are studies that show that they can offer similar outcomes. We can talk about differences in the supportive medicines, and these often are where patients experience very significant out-of-pocket costs, not necessarily the chemotherapy per se, where there may be less options, but the anti-nausea medicines, the antibiotics, treatments for blood clots and things of that nature. There are lots of choices that doctors can make with you, and there are enormous price variations. The other thing that you may have to be aware of and work with your healthcare providing team to be aware of is depending on what your coverage plan allows. Certain drugs may be very inexpensive and other almost identical drugs may be very expensive, whereas the next patient that walks into that doctor's office with exactly your condition but a different insurance company, it may be just the opposite. And this reflects that a number of the companies that are providing drugs to patients have worked out specific deals, specific arrangements, whereby they have a lower price for one particular blood thinner or one particular form of a drug or one particular class of antibiotics and not another. And these are important things to be aware of because you don't want to be compromising your ability to take the medicines by having limits on the amount of money that you can spend on it. I can't emphasize enough how important it is that whatever you're doing, whatever you're taking, whatever you're not taking, whatever you're having trouble affording, whatever you're not, be in communication with your doctor and your healthcare provider. If money is a problem, is an impediment to getting the treatment, as soon as your doctor knows about it, then the ball is in his or her court to help you with that. With that, I'm going to pause and hand the program back over to Carolyn, and I'd be happy to take questions at the end.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Saltz. You really did a wonderful job setting the stage for the program and identifying really key issues and, of course, the real significance for everyone on the call to bring your concerns to your treating healthcare team. It's really to be really upfront with them. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Deborah Wolf. Deborah Wolf is Supervising Attorney, Legal Health, New York Legal Assistance Group, or NILAC. Ms. Wolf is an attorney. She will be presenting the following topics to you. I really appreciate her doing this. Access to health plans, Medicare and Medicaid coverage, the benefits and limitations of your health plans, insurance, Medicare and Medicaid coverage, tips on appealing your insurance, Medicare claims and provider denials, and living wills, healthcare proxies, and advanced healthcare directives. Please sit back, listen to Ms. Wolf's presentation. Also, please be aware that this program is being recorded and it is available to you after the program as a replay or as a podcast. You can listen to it. And so don't feel if you can't capture everything at the exact moment it's being said, you have opportunities to hear it again. But I'm really delighted, and I'm going to turn this program now over to Ms. Wolf.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I'm so pleased to be a part of this workshop with Cancer Care. As we all know, it's a time of transition for health insurance, but for now, the Affordable Care Act is still being implemented, and any change is still a ways off. In discussing access to health coverage, it's important to know that there are different types of insurance plans, and these include group policies from employment, union benefits, and privately purchased policies, as well as policies available through the current state or federal marketplace. I'll also briefly discuss Medicaid and Medicare. The insurance laws of your state may also require certain minimum benefits, so your rights vary depending on where you live. This will be very general advice relating to all, but it's also important to understand the laws of the state you live in. Access to coverage is very dependent on the type of health insurance you're seeking. I'm going to start with work-based policies, then individual plans, and finally Medicare and Medicaid. Besides the Affordable Care Act, there are other laws regarding health care that are important when looking at access to work-based coverage. Two older laws, HIPAA and ERISA, offer legal protections as well. You've probably all heard of HIPAA. Part of this law called Title II protects medical privacy. When you go to see your doctor and you sign in and they immediately cover your name and give you many forms to sign, that's a result of HIPAA privacy rules. But there's another part of HIPAA, Title I, which protects access to health insurance coverage for workers and their families when they start a new job or change jobs. Under HIPAA, work group plans cannot establish rules of eligibility, charge greater premium, or deny enrollment based on an employee's health. So as a result, anyone who elects work coverage is charged the same, has equal access, and cannot be denied coverage. And as of now, plans can't refuse to cover pre-existing conditions. Since we've all been hearing and reading so much about pre-existing conditions, it makes sense to take a minute to understand what this means. The law generally defines a pre-existing condition as one for which medical advice, diagnosis, care, or treatment was recommended or received during the six-month period prior to an individual's enrollment date. So it only allows exclusion of pre-existing conditions for which you were seen or treated in the past 6 months. But even before the Affordable Care Act, HIPAA offered protections regarding pre-existing conditions and set a maximum length of 12 months on pre-existing condition exclusions. After 12 months, it would be covered. HIPAA also requires something called portability. If a person is changing insurance and the new plan has a pre-existing condition exclusion, it can't be applied if that person switched from one insurance plan to the new plan without more than a 63-day gap in coverage. This is called portability. We really haven't had to look at portability since the Affordable Care Act, but it does offer protection should the law regarding pre-existing conditions change, so it's important to know. There's another law for work-based plans called ERISA, which offers many of the protections under the Affordable Care Act regarding the insured's right to complete plan information and appeals, which I'll discuss shortly. For someone without work coverage who does not qualify for Medicare or Medicaid, a health insurance marketplace operates in each state. And in the marketplace, you can compare different plans, see if you're entitled to government subsidies to lower the cost, or determine if you may be eligible for free coverage under Medicaid. You can also access this information at the federal site, healthcare.gov. There's many different levels of plans, so it's important to look at the cost. The plans also vary with respect to deductibles, cost sharing, co-payments, so it's really important to look at all these aspects to determine what's going to be best, the best coverage for you. in the marketplace, a person can't be denied insurance based on their health, and most insurers still can no longer refuse coverage of pre-existing conditions. Another important change is the requirement that insurance companies can no longer limit the amount that they'll pay for medical costs over the year or the person's lifetime. There's no monetary caps on coverage. This means that an insurance company can no longer say, once we spend a certain amount of money, you're no longer covered. Insurance policies are still also available through brokers. These plans are often more costly but may have better coverage. And finally, if you belong to an association or a group, these often offer group health plans at a less expensive rate. As an example for me, the American Bar Association, I have a friend who's a writer who joined a writing guild and has group insurance through them. And there's even freelancer group plans in many states, so some research is necessary depending on your circumstances. Moving to Medicare and Medicaid, these are both government-sponsored health insurance. Medicare is a federal program with rules that are uniform to all participants in all 50 states. Medicare is available to most people age 65 or older who are citizens or permanent residents. And if under age 65, a person who's been receiving Social Security disability benefits for a period of 24 months. Medicare is not available to others, with some very limited exceptions. Medicare coverage consists of a number of parts. Part A, which provides free hospital coverage, Part B, medical insurance, which requires a monthly premium, and Part D, the prescription drug insurance plans, which are provided through private companies that have contracts with the government. There's also Part C, which allows private health insurance companies such as HMOs to provide Medicare benefits. And these Medicare private health plans are sometimes known as Medicare Advantage plans and are chosen in lieu of Parts B and D. Now, Medicare recipients are entitled to the same essential health benefits. However, Medicare generally does not cover the entire cost of medical treatment, often only up to 80%, but the remaining 20% can be very costly, especially with the cost of cancer treatment. So many people purchase additional Medicare gap policies to supplement Medicare, and I do want to point out that these policies are exempt from the Affordable Care Act requirements, and some do have pre-existing condition exclusions. So it's important to make sure to read the plans and ask questions to understand all the benefits. For people who are lower income, Medicaid can also serve as a supplemental policy to Medicare. Medicare rules can be complicated, especially if someone is turned 65 and is still working, so I always advise clients to speak with an expert. One good resource is the website medicare.gov, and there's also a nonprofit organization, the Medicare Rights Center, who are experts in navigating the complexities of Medicare, and they have a very interactive website that can answer many questions at medicarerights.org. It's important to know that enrollment in both marketplace plans and Medicare take place during an open enrollment period, and if a patient misses these deadlines, they may have to wait until the following year. There's exceptions, such as when someone is losing other coverage, so again, make sure to speak to someone knowledgeable in this area. Moving now to Medicaid, this is a federal-state partnership with shared authority and financing. Certain eligibility rules are established mainly by each state and vary depending on where you live, so it's important to know your state Medicaid requirements. Access is based on being low income with a limit on how much you can have in income and assets. For those who are disabled or elderly with higher income, one can often become eligible through special Medicaid programs. If you qualify, Medicaid recipients are also entitled to the same benefit packages that are available in most of the plans in the health insurance exchanges. Now, in about one half the states, Medicaid has been expanded to increase coverage to more lower income people who haven't always had access to Medicaid. And as I mentioned earlier, one application will determine eligibility for Medicaid or a health plan through the marketplace, as well as any subsidies for the premium. Medicaid is free, and it's desirable for many older people with cancer because it offers often needed home nursing or home attendance for help in the home, as well as nursing home coverage. Moving now to how to understand the benefits and limitations of your health plans, the most important advice I can give is have and read a copy of your policy, or at the very least a summary description. This will outline your benefits, any coverage limits, and the appeals process, which I'll discuss shortly. Your insurance company representative can also be a very good resource to call if you have questions about what is or is not covered. You also need to know whether your policy is an HMO, which allows only in-network doctors, or a plan that allows for out-of-network doctors, but often at a much reduced reimbursement rate. With an HMO, you generally have a copayment and sometimes a deductible, but that's the extent of your financial responsibility if your doctor is in-network. With other policies, your out-of-network doctor may be able to bill you directly for any amount not paid by your insurance. If you have an HMO, make sure all your doctors are in-network, and if you're having surgery, make sure any of the doctors involved, such as an anesthesiologist, are also in-network. Policies can still limit certain coverages, such as physical therapy visits or home nursing visits allowed per year. So you really do have to review the insurance policy and discuss with those who offer support, such as your medical team or a social worker, to make sure you'll be covered for all necessary treatment and care. Also make sure either, you know, you check with your doctor's office or your insurance company to confirm that any procedure which requires pre-authorization is approved. But even with the protections I've discussed, claims are sometimes denied. Your insurance company is required to provide an explanation of benefit, or an EOB, for each claim reviewed. The EOB outlines the amount paid by your insurance, your required contribution, which can be your copay, and if not paying, the reasons for the denial. It's important to read every explanation of benefit to make sure your claim has been paid, and if not, the reasons for the denial. When a claim is denied, your first step should be to call the insurance company right away to discuss. There's many reasons a claim may be denied, and often the insurance company just needs more documentation from your doctor's office to approve. Claims are also sometimes denied for administrative reasons that are easy to fix. Make sure to keep track of every call or letter writing, down the date, and who you spoke with at your insurance company. Health plans and insurance companies have to tell you why they've decided to deny a claim with very specific information. You also have the right to request a full copy of your insurance file to see how they reached their decision, including notes made by the case handler. If the matter can't be resolved by speaking with the insurance company, you have the right to file an appeal directly to your insurance company. Often the first appeal is submitted through your doctor's office, so also talk to your medical team. In your appeal, you have to document the reasons you disagree with the insurance company and always include medical records and a letter from your treating doctor. Your insurance company must conduct a full and fair review, and if urgent, they must expedite this process. If your insurance company denies the appeal, you then have the right to request an external review, which gives you the right to file an appeal to an outside, objective, and independent panel, no matter where you live and what type of insurance you have. This means that independent medical professionals with no financial stake in the claim make the decision. If the external reviewer overturns your insurance company's denial, your insurer must give you the payments or services you requested in your claim. It's important to make sure you understand that there are time limits to file an appeal, as these are very strict deadlines. If you have a policy from employment, the time limit is usually 180 days. For other plans, or with Medicaid or Medicare, the deadline is often as short as 60 days. If a claim is denied, you'll receive written notice about how to appeal, so make sure to read these EOBs carefully. The good news is that around half of all denied claims that are appealed are finally allowed, and the percentage for external reviews is even higher. if you draw on all the resources available to you and you have adequate medical support for your claim, you stand a good chance of having your claim paid. I know it's difficult to keep on top of insurance matters with everything else going on, but with an understanding of your rights and responsibilities, you'll be able to navigate any insurance issues or questions that come up. I'm now going to speak about advance directives, which are documents prepared in advance that address a person's right to decide what medical care they choose to receive and who they choose to communicate with their medical team if they become unable to do so. The laws vary in every state, so it's important to know your state laws as well. The healthcare proxy form allows you to name an agent to make healthcare decisions for you if you become incapacitated and unable to communicate your wishes to your doctor. The form is usually simple to prepare, requires witnesses, and generally doesn't require an attorney. It's important that the healthcare proxy be executed while someone is able to understand what the document means. Although prepared when someone has capacity, it generally doesn't take effect until a person is unable to communicate their healthcare wishes to their doctor. As long as you're able to make your healthcare decisions known, your doctor will discuss with you. Once the doctors have determined that the patient is incapacitated, the named agent can consult with doctors, examine the medical records, and make important healthcare decisions. If no healthcare proxy is signed, many states also have surrogate decision-making laws that determine who can make decisions for this patient. This might include family and even close friends. But it's important to execute a healthcare proxy regardless, as the law may have limits. But more important, a person should have the choice as to who they trust with these decisions. Your agent is obligated to advocate for your wishes, not decide what he or she thinks is best for you, and you should choose an agent who's willing and able to meet this challenge. It's really important to discuss what your wishes are with your agent. Next, I want to talk about the living will, which is a statement of one's wishes with respect to potential end-of-life medical care decisions and can serve as guidance to your healthcare agent and healthcare providers. The living will is different from a healthcare proxy in that the proxy chooses someone to make decisions, and the living will sets forth what a person's wishes are. A living will generally applies when it's determined that the patient is in an incurable or irreversible condition with no reasonable expectation of recovery and includes decisions such as artificial respiration, CPR, artificial nutrition or hydration, and invasive procedures that will prolong a life but not give a better quality of life. And like the healthcare proxy, a living will is a simple form to complete. I want to finally mention another important form that's very useful in the healthcare setting, and this is a power of attorney. This form allows an individual to name an agent to handle their personal affairs during their lifetime, including banking, insurance, and other financial matters. The form generally needs to be notarized, and it's important to have someone you trust as your agent. Although a power of attorney does not cover healthcare issues, it can be very useful in that if someone needs to apply for Medicaid, bank records may need to be submitted, and the agent can access these with a power of attorney. A power of attorney can often avoid the need to have a court-appointed guardian, which can be a long and expensive process. With a power of attorney, the person will have someone able to help pay bills, handle insurance matters and benefits, whatever your needs may be. I know that this has been a lot of information, but it's important to understand what these documents are and how they help both the patient as well as their family and their medical providers take action that's not only in the best interests of the patient, but follows their wishes as well. I also want to briefly mention that there is a National Cancer Legal Service Network, a group of attorneys like myself who offer free legal advice to people with cancer, and you can check to see what help may be available to you in your state, and the website is nclsn.org. And with that, I'm going to turn this back to Dr. Messner, and I, too, will be available for questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Wolf. That was really outstanding. And very comprehensive, and I think that I think people are listening to this with great interest, because indeed these, you covered a lot of the important areas that people are concerned about and need this information about. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. Our next speaker is Ms. Michelle McCourt. Ms. McCourt is Senior Director, Cancer Care Copayment Assistance Foundation. And Ms. McCourt is going to address what are copayment assistance programs and how to access copayment assistance programs. So it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. McCourt.
Thank you, Carolyn. Good afternoon, everyone. As Carolyn said, my topic today is understanding and accessing copayment assistance programs. There are several different types of programs available to help patients get access to their prescribed therapies. There are pharmaceutical manufacturer programs. To qualify for this type of program, the patient has to be taking a medication manufactured by the drug company. The drug company will typically offer two types of programs, one for uninsured or underinsured patients, and another for patients that have commercial insurance. For the uninsured, these programs are usually referred to as patient assistance programs. In order to qualify, the patient must have no insurance or has insurance, but their plan excludes that medication from its formulary or list of covered drugs. If eligible for a manufactured patient assistance program, the drug is provided free. This may be for a 90-day supply or until the end of the calendar year. For patients with private or commercial insurance, many of the drug companies offer copayment assistance programs. Some programs provide coupons, and the most a patient may have to pay out of pocket for the medication is $25. Others offer a copayment assistance program that will cover the entire copay cost through a copay card. In order to be eligible for these programs, there is usually an income criteria, and the patient cannot have insurance through a federal health or state insurance program, such as Medicare or Medicaid. To find out about these types of programs, you can check with your doctor or pharmacist, or you can do an internet search using the name of the drug as your search criteria. Another important website that keeps a current listing of these programs is needymeds.org. You can also contact an organization like Cancer Care that provides these types of referrals. Other copayment assistance programs are offered by independent not-for-profit organizations and are referred to as copayment assistance foundations. These foundations can assist patients with any type of insurance, including patients with federal health insurance like Medicare. The difference with these programs is they are administered by nonprofit charities. The charity is an independent organization and is not affiliated with the pharmaceutical company. The funding is available based on diagnosis. So these programs are disease-specific, whereas the pharmaceutical programs are drug-specific. There are approximately 12 national copayment assistance foundations. Some provide assistance with copayments and coinsurance for prescription medications, while others also offer assistance with insurance premiums and transportation costs. Once you have been referred to a foundation, get in touch with them right away to start the application process. Each foundation has its own eligibility criteria and enrollment process, but all must follow and operate their programs based on federal guidance established for providing copayment assistance. All foundations have set financial, medical, and insurance criteria that need to be verified as part of the approval process. If approved, most foundations will establish a third-party payer relationship with the pharmacy or infusion provider, or provide an access card that can be used for payment. Some things to keep in mind as far as limitations with the foundations: the donations that the foundations receive are for a specific type of disease. So, for example, for our foundation, the patient's primary cancer diagnosis must match the fund that we have open, and the patient must be receiving treatment to treat that disease. Our foundation covers chemotherapy and targeted treatment medications. That includes both infused and oral chemotherapy. With limited funding, we are not able to cover infusion, administrative fees, or office visits. We also don't cover radiation costs. Patients are given an initial grant amount, and once that amount is met, they can appeal for additional funds. The additional funding will be based on available funds and if the fund is still open. Funding is always limited, and funds will open and close at various times throughout the year. The best way to find out about all of these assistance programs is to discuss these financial concerns with your healthcare team, who can put you in touch with a financial counselor or a social worker that can help you find assistance. You can also get in touch with organizations such as Cancer Care that can provide you with these financial resources. Thank you. I will stop here now and hand this back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Michelle. That was very informative, and I think a lot of people really take a wonderful advantage of these programs that can help tremendously with your care. And our next speaker is Ms. Jane Levy. Ms. Levy is an oncology social worker, and she is Director of Patient Assistance Programs here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Levy is going to address support for the underinsured and uninsured, including Medicaid, other resources for financial help, and Cancer Care's free programs and services. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Levy.
Hello, I'm Jane Levy, Director of Patient Assistance Programs at Cancer Care, and I know this is a topic of interest for all of you. Cancer is an expensive illness, and financial concerns are pervasive, as well as a significant source of stress for patients and families. However, as all our speakers have noted, and I will underscore, having an open conversation about the cost of cancer can help you become better informed about your options, and you may be able to reduce the financial impact of your illness. When patients and families talk about the cost of cancer, they really, I say, fall into three areas of financial concern. There are the direct medical expenses, hospital and doctor bills, cancer drugs and other medications, as well as medical copays. Many of those costs will be covered by your insurance, but those that are not can often be covered through assistance programs. There are those related medical expenses that are not covered by insurance, things like transportation, gas, parking, very often home care, child care, medical supplies, over-the-counter medications, food supplements, lodging, and the cost of insurance. And then again, there are those expenses of daily living, things like rent, mortgage, food, utilities, and taxes. So I'll try to briefly address those areas and where you can look for help. When it comes to managing medical expenses, it pays to be informed and upfront. As our other speakers have said, it's very important to understand your insurance policy so you are not blindsided by charges. So if you are having difficulty, reach out for help, and you can even ask your insurance company to assign you a case manager. It's very important to keep a diary of all your expenses so you can catch billing errors. This is very important. And, you know, when people ask cancer patients, what can I do to help? One of the things you may say is, help me with my bills. Help me go through and organize and keep track. This is so hard when you're ill and you're overwhelmed. It's just so easy to throw them into a shoebox. But you do want to try to keep on top of them. And number three, talk to your healthcare team as soon as possible about your financial situation. Speaking to your oncologist or the healthcare team about financial concerns, as Dr. Saltz mentioned, is no longer a taboo subject. Physicians and healthcare providers are more sensitive to cost, and they connect you, and they may be able to connect you to people who know about resources. They are your hospital social workers, they are financial coordinators, they may be discharge planners or resource specialists. And these are the people who, in turn, can direct you to organizations and entitlement programs, things such as Michelle mentioned, like copay assistance and pharmaceutical support, applications for transportation assistance and government entitlements, as well as many communities have freestanding local cancer organizations that can provide direct financial support. And again, it's so important not to delay when applying for any benefits, as these take time to process. If medical bills threaten to overwhelm you, the experts recommend that you speak up immediately, as many settings may offer a payment plan. They may even agree to cut the charges, or they may have special fundings for patients who are uninsured or underinsured. And as Dr. Saltz mentioned, they may suggest other options regarding your care. By all means, do not ignore bills, for once they go into collections, they are harder to resolve. Aside with getting help for medical expenses, when it comes to living expenses, let all your creditors know about your financial situation and your illness. You may be surprised by the positive response from phone and utility companies, even landlords, willing to work with you before a crisis develops. Also, many voluntary and government organizations, such as county and local governments, often have special assistance set aside for emergencies, emergency assistance, eviction protection programs, rent assistance, food programs, property tax relief, as well as energy assistance. How do you find these programs? Well, for starters, you can call us here at Cancer Care, speak to any of our oncology social workers. You can also turn to some of the people that I spoke to, your hospital social workers and resource specialists. There are also many helpful websites. And by the way, you can go to our cancer care website under financial assistance to find them. One of them that is very helpful is the united211.org website. This is funded by the United Way. You can search by zip code, and you can find all the voluntary organizations in your area that help with all sorts of financial assistance. Your area agency on aging also has a list of resources for people over 60, including where you can go for one-on-one case management. Voluntary organizations such as Cancer Care, the Patient Advocate Foundation, and the American Cancer Society all maintain extensive databases on local resources. These organizations can also sometimes provide direct help with expenses, such as transportation, medical equipment, and lodging. Our Cancer Care website has a helpful fact sheet on tips for managing the cost of care. It has our Helping Hand database of resources, as well as another website called CFAC, and that's a coalition of 8 organizations, the Cancer Financial Assistance Coalition, and we have put together also a resource database. Again, you can always call our Hope Line, 1-800-813-4673, and talk to one of our oncology social workers. In conclusion, it's important to always review all your income and expenses to see where you can economize. Complete a budget workshop. Above all, talk to your healthcare team about the cost of your care. Stay on top of your medical bills. Find out which government programs you are eligible to apply for and apply promptly. Learn how financial and copay assistance programs can help you, and get help from professionals who can help you deal with this stress. Get informed, speak up, get organized, and ask for help. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Jane. That was really excellent and very informative. Lot of wonderful resources. And I should say that all the resources mentioned during this program will be sent to you again. And when you get the evaluation form, you'll have a whole listing of the resources, the phone numbers, and the websites, so that you'll have all that information as well. Well, now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Crystal to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, because there's a lot of you on the call, at the very end of the call, I will give you resources to get your questions answered. But why don't we start now? I'm going to have Crystal give you instructions on how to ask questions, and we'll take them as quickly as we can. Okay.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. And those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Barbara A. Your line is open. Please check that your line is not on mute. And we're going to move on to our next question from Stephanie K. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Caroline. It's an excellent seminar as usual. I am a breast cancer survivor, but I am also a social worker and a psychiatric nurse, and I'm working with a family member who has Medicare and Medicaid, and I'd like to find out what is happening because a lot of doctors are dropping out of Medicare, and of course, the Medicaid part, they're refusing to take that, and they won't even take the cash because this is illegal to take the cash for the Medicaid. So what is this person supposed to do? Well, he's looking for different doctors. It's a big, big, big problem. I'm finding out from other people, too. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Stephanie, for that excellent question. I'm going to ask actually Deborah Wolf to address it first, and then I think Jane Levy afterwards. But do you want to start, Deborah, with that one?
Sure. I mean, I have not really heard about this issue from clients that I've spoken to recently. A lot of my clients are what they call dual eligible, having both Medicaid and Medicare, in which case Medicare is always primary and Medicaid pays secondary. But I have to say that I haven't really heard about doctors dropping out of Medicare, so I'm wondering if maybe somebody on the medical side might be able to address that.
Okay. And Jane, do you want to comment on that as well?
I'm not as familiar. I would think that that patients would do best maybe seeking their care in a hospital setting as opposed to a private practice setup, because in those settings, most of the patients, at least from the patients that I speak to across the country, are still accepting Medicare and Medicaid. I think, like I said, maybe through an oncology clinic or an academic setting.
And Dr. Caroline, Fox,
could
you
I
want to comment
on that
too?
Yeah, please. Yeah, please. Sure. It is a real issue. Now, I'm speaking to you as somebody who's full-time faculty at an academic medical center, so I don't have financial relationships with my patients. I far prefer it that way. And I think that, as was just said, often the best option for somebody who's having that kind of difficulty is to go to if at all possible, an academic cancer center where the faculty and you won't have that financial interaction. The harsh reality is the payment to doctors for Medicare and Medicaid is substantially lower than through most private insurance. Medicaid's payment to doctors is so trivial that often doctors just regard it as pro bono work and don't even submit the bill because the reimbursement is literally as low as less than $10 per visit. And so doctors who are in private practice, which one has to respect is essentially a small business, are sometimes forced to make the decision that it is not possible for them to run their business and work with Medicaid and or Medicare. So there are alternatives, but unfortunately there may not be universal access for people who are in programs that are paying what the doctors in private practice perceive as below market rate.
Thank you. And I also just want to also suggest that many people, of course, are maybe getting their treatment at large as academic centers or large hospitals. And also there are public hospitals in many of the larger cities. And some of those hospitals, of course, are mandated to take care for you. So I would suggest if you're having difficulty like that, Stephanie, that's a very good question. Others on the call as well. I would say to go ahead and call our social workers here at Cancer Care just as a start to actually get some individual guidance in terms of where you live and where there might be institutions that are larger settings that indeed, I think, as Dr. Salt said, the physician does not have a private practice. They are they're somewhat interesting point removed from that process of payment to some extent, and so the institution, you're really dealing with a physician who's really seeing all the people who make appointments and see them. It's different than a private practice, so that may be something that could be very helpful to people. So, but some of you may be attached to a physician or that you know, and so that creates a transition in care. But I would suggest contacting our social work staff here at 1-800-813-4673, who at least can look at the situation individually and give you some individual help with that as well. So I hope that helps.
If I could make one last comment, for better or for worse, and it's intended to be for better, it is not legal for a doctor to accept additional payment over what Medicare or Medicaid offers. So one can't make that offer to a doctor who has decided not to participate in the program. Doctors cannot select and do some patients and others. They can either be in the program or not in the program. But if they're in the program, part of their acceptance of that is accepting that they will consider payment from Medicaid or Medicare is payment in full.
Oh, excellent. That's a very good point for everyone to know. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So we have an online question from one of our participants here on the call, and I'm going to direct this question to Deborah. We actually have a program coming up on this topic. This will be part three on cancer in the workplace, but why don't we give a purview of it in here. I'm terrified. I don't have a lot of savings, and I'm not sure how I can continue to work when I have my treatments. What if I lose my job? The question is, can I continue working, will I lose my insurance if I lose my job? Deborah, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of that start with?
Sure, and I will encourage you to join us next week as I'll be covering a lot of the laws that protect people in the workplace that I really don't have the time to get into now. But as it relates to insurance, there are laws that say that particularly a law called COBRA that says if somebody stops working for any reason, whether it's because they quit their job, whether it's because they can no longer work because of health, or even if they're fired, that they have the right to continue their work group insurance for a period of at least 18 months, and in some cases longer. That means that you can continue to keep your health insurance. You will have to pay at the group rate. You'll have to pay the entire premium, but it's usually lower than what a private policy would cost. If somebody leaves their job for medical reasons, they're protected under a law called FMLA that allows them to continue their health insurance for 3 months. And in that 3 months, the employer still has to pay their portion of the health insurance. So a lot of different scenarios. We also look at what the income is going to be and whether or not somebody might qualify for Medicaid. A lot of that will depend on what state you live in. So a lot of different options. But, the first thing we generally will look at is what the cost of COBRA will be and whether or not that's an option to continue your health insurance.
Thank you. And Dr. Saltz, if you could just comment on the concept. Many people, of course, are always worried when initially diagnosed that they won't be able to continue working. And could you just comment on the current treatment for many cancers that really do enable some or many people to continue working? It's a reasonable concern to have and to bring up with the healthcare team, but if you could just give a little bit of backdrop to that, it might be helpful for this caller and others on the call as well.
Right. Of course, this is going to vary tremendously from person to person, but what I try to emphasize to patients when we first meet and we're talking about putting a treatment plan in place, firstly, that chemotherapy is just a fancy word for drugs. Okay, doctors like big words. No self-respecting doctor is going to use a one-syllable word when a five-syllable word will do. But it's really just a matter of using drugs to try to treat cancer. And what that means is there are many different drugs. So firstly, one person's experience is not going to be the same as another's, either positive or negative. And secondly, that what I explain is my goal as a person's doctor is I want me and the treatment to be a minor inconvenience in their life, but not to be the dominant factor, and that we very much want to try to tailor the therapy so that it's manageable. That doesn't mean it's going to always be a walk in the park. I wish we were that good, but we're not. But that much of the time, and hopefully most of the time, the person's going to be able to function at the level that they were before the cancer happened, and to be able to continue working to a large degree if they were working. We find that employers are often extremely accommodating, and that we're able to keep people functioning a lot. So don't make the assumption that starting on a course of treatment means that you have to drop out of work, drop out of life, drop out of society. Usually that's not the case, and we work very hard to make it not be the case.
Excellent. Thank you. And I do want to encourage you and others, I'll be saying the same at the end too, but we do have a program on May 24th on cancer in the workplace, understanding legal protections, and we do actually go into more detail around some of the issues that were brought up today. So if that's of interest to you, please do. Some of you have signed up for it already, but just if you didn't know about that. We have another question from one of our online participants, and I'm going to direct this question initially to Deborah, probably, and then perhaps others. I didn't expect to get breast cancer and put only $300 in my flexible spending account. Are there tax deductions I can take for my medical bills? Can I increase my flexible spending account? Deborah, if you could just address this in a general way in terms of, but obviously people are often surprised and taken by surprise by a diagnosis and
sure.
May have planned differently. Yes.
So sounds like there's two questions here. One is with the flexible spending. It's my understanding that you make an election at the beginning of the flexible spending year, and that once you make that decision about how much you're going to deposit, you have to stay with that decision for the year. But I will say that I've never looked into whether or not there's any circumstance that might justify a change in that. I'm guessing the answer to that is no, but it certainly would be worth exploring. But usually when you opt for flex spending, the amount that you originally determined to deposit into your account is the amount that you're going to stay with for the year. With respect to the tax deductions for medical expenses, the answer is for somebody with very high medical expenses, there are tax deductions that are allowed. I'm not an accountant. I know it has to be a certain percentage of your income, so I would encourage you to speak with your accountant to talk about what those percentages are. But generally, if somebody does have extraordinarily high medical costs, there is a provision in the tax code that allows for a deduction.
Excellent. Thank you. And this will be the last actually question. I'm going to direct it to Dennis McCourt, actually. So I'm on Medicare. How much can I expect it to cover my chemotherapy and radiation treatments? Copays are so expensive. How much does copay help typically cover? And so perhaps the issue, I know, Ms. McCourt, you have a great knowledge of there are copay assistance for people who have Medicare as well. So if you could just comment on that, that might be very helpful for this caller and others as well.
Yeah, so typically Medicare, so if you have Medicare A and B and you're taking an infused therapy, Medicare will cover 20% of your coinsurance or of your, you know, you'll have to pay 20%. Medicare will pay 80%, I'm sorry, and you'll have to pay 20%. Now, if you have a Medicare supplemental plan, which is also referred to as a Medigap plan, then you might not have a copay because that Medigap plan will pick up 20% that Medicare doesn't. For patients that are taking oral medications and have a Part D plan, those out-of-pocket costs are a little bit more because you have to go into different phases of coverage. You have your deductible phase, and then you have your coinsurance phase, and then you actually have what is referred to as a coverage gap where you have to pay 100%. When you're getting assistance from a charity, from a nonprofit organization, and if you qualify for assistance for a drug that's covered under your Part D plan, everything that the charity pays out of pocket, you know, pays for you for your out-of-pocket cost does count, and get you through that coverage gap and into the catastrophic. When you're in the catastrophic phase, that is actually a 5% copay. And the copay foundations typically will still cover you during that catastrophic phase. So, you know, depending on the type of medication that you're taking, really you can get in and out of that donut hole with your first month of an oral chemotherapy medication.
Excellent. Very helpful. Well, this has been an amazing call. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been extraordinary, I must say. This is amazing. So I want to thank you all. I want to thank all of you who've also asked such excellent questions, both on the telephone and online, very important questions. Now, we have many more questions, so I did want to let everybody know how to get your questions answered. So if any of you have a medical question about your particular treatment for your cancer or questions about your medical care, I do recommend that, of course, you go to your treating healthcare team. However, if you would like to get information from a credible source, just to get some general information, I do recommend that you contact the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237, or you can visit their website at www.cancer.gov. And their website does have a live chat feature where you can post your question, and they can be extraordinarily helpful to you around your medical concerns. If, on the other hand, you would like some just practical assistance or financial assistance, or some of the questions that even came up today that you're still not quite sure about, or you would like to talk with one of our oncology social workers here at Cancer Care, join a support group, or take advantage of our services here, then I suggest you contact Cancer Care. You can call us at 1-800-813-4673. And for both people in the United States and internationally who prefer our website, you can go to www.cancercare.org, and you can post your question, and you will be assigned to a social worker who will help you, you know, with your questions and your concerns, and really spend time with you to kind of address what your concerns are and help to provide you resources to resolve your questions. It's always good to connect them. We will also connect you with other organizations that we think can help alongside us. So we definitely are there to be there for you. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, we don't want, and I certainly don't want any of you to feel like you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of this community here, that we are here to help you, and we're simply a phone call away or a mouse click away on your computer to reaching us. And do take advantage of these services. They are free, and we're but one of many, many support organizations out there that we can link you to. And as I mentioned during the call, this is part two of a five-part series, so there's much more to come. And so there is a program next week on cancer in the workplace, and for those of you who might be interested in that one, it's on May 24th, and some of you have signed up already, but if you haven't, please do. And with that all being said, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.